I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome all our listeners to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we are marking in this episode a monumental moment in the history of the United States and, frankly, the history of the entire world. D-Day, at 80 years old. We're going to take a look at the importance of Operation Overlord, its significance, its importance, including the essential leadership of Dwight Eisenhower. And I'm joined for this really interesting conversation today by an old friend, personal friend of mine, a friend of the Ashbrook Center and all of our programs for teachers, Professor David Krugler. Those of you who don't know him, David is professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. He is an outstanding scholar of World War II and of the Cold War, having written a number of books and articles on that subject. He is also, interestingly, a terrific mystery writer, and he has published a number of interesting, fun, engaging, and historically deeply informed novels. Rip the Angels from Heaven is one of them. And he has been recently published in a collection on the best mysteries of 2023. So we have an interesting human being with us today, folks. And I want to also, of course, plug his wonderful edited volume that he's done for our Teaching American History resources called The Cold War, Core Documents Collection. David Krugler, as always, great to have you on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be back with you and talking about this significant and engrossing subject.
Yeah, I mean, today we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of D-Day. I think everybody probably among our listeners knows, but just for our own sake, refresh our memories. When people talk about D-Day, what are they actually talking about?
They're talking about an operation formerly known as Overlord, which was launched from southern England across the English Channel into northern France along the coast of Normandy. This was one of the most, if not the most, anticipated Allied offensives of the war in any theater, in both Europe and the Pacific theater. Within one day, 150,000 Allied troops had landed. They were carried by more than 1,000 specially designed ships, which brought the personnel to the beaches. There were five beaches. Canadian, British, and U.S. troops were among those landing. One of the beaches experienced heavy fire. It was the most well-defended, incurring losses of nearly 5,000 American lives lost. But I do want to note that the British and Canadian troops were part of the invading force. This gave the Allies a foothold in German-held France or Vichy-occupied France, and opened pathways, very difficult pathways to open, but nonetheless successful pathways opened, bringing the final defeat of Germany, along with Red Army action from the East.
All right. Remind our listeners, what is the state of World War II? Because June 6, 1944 is D-Day, Operation Overlord. But what's the state of play in June of 1944 in World War II, both in Europe and briefly, I guess, also in the Pacific?
We'll make a couple notes about the state of the war in Europe first. And that involves recognition of tremendous Soviet victories at Stalingrad in the year before, and also at Kursk in the summer of 1943. The battle for Stalingrad, which raged for several weeks from late 1942 into 1943, halted German advances into the east. And from that point forward, on the Eastern Front, the Germans were fighting to hold territory. They were not gaining territory. And so the slow and very difficult counteroffensive of the Red Army proceeds. That makes the D-Day landing even more, gives it more chance of success. We also want to take note of the fruits of Allied strategic bombing, which were starting to degrade Germany's ability to mobilize for war and to replace lost equipment, particularly planes and tanks. In the Pacific, progress is moving slower. The island hopping campaign is underway, but in the summer of 1944, no one can speak of being on the edge of a turning point in the Pacific. That can be said in the summer of 1944 if D-Day is successful.
Mm-hmm. And we also, by that time, we have attacks of the Allied forces up through the southern part of Europe in Italy as well.
Yes, it's often overlooked that the day before the D-Day landings, Allied troops liberated Rome. And so the Italian fascist government was brought down. Not all of Italy was under Allied control. There was still fierce German resistance, particularly in the mountainous areas of Italy. But that was a major, major victory. And that had been made possible by the first American landings through the Mediterranean in what's known as Operation Torch, which took place in November of 1942 in North Africa.
Right. So the United States and the Allies, the Western Allies, decide they're going to invade across the channel from England into northwestern France. Why did they think opening up the second front in Europe was so important?
All sides knew that for the Allies to oust the Germans from occupied nations and territories and to close in on Germany itself, some sort of landing in Europe was needed. And the logical place, the obvious place, was across the English Channel into German-held northern France. One of the strategic blunders, and there were many that Hitler made, was to not neutralize or conquer Great Britain. Now, thank God he didn't, but for a while it seemed as if Britain could be forced to surrender. But Hitler, for a variety of reasons, chose not to carry out amphibious landings against Great Britain. And so that island nation becomes secure by 1944. And that enables not only the strategic bombing of the United States 8th Air Force, which is based in southern England, but also preparation for that landing.
All right. The landing itself, how many troops does it involve? How do they get across the channel to northwestern France? And how do you keep a thing like that secret?
You know, that's a great question, Jeff. And the way to keep it secret is to drop another secret. So one of the extraordinary stories of D-Day is Operation Fortitude, which involved an elaborate fake-out to convince Hitler and the Germans that the Allies would cross the channel at its narrowest point. This is actually northeast of Normandy, and arrive at a point known as Pas-de-Calais. And so a fake army group was created. And some of the troops involved had backgrounds in theater, in carpentry, in preparing props. And this was their greatest play yet. So for the occasional German aerial reconnaissance that takes place, they spot assembled tanks. They're fakes. Radio.
And they're fakes as in they made them and they're not real tanks?
Right. They're mock-ups. Just like in a Hollywood scene, the buildings are only fronts and there's nothing behind them. And radio networks were set up. And it was so convincing that Hitler ordered reserves held to rush to Pas-de-Calais. And the fake-out also involved convincing the Germans that another landing would take place there after the D-Day landing. So what you're trying to do is deflect. You can't keep it secret once it lands, right? But you can convince your enemy, hopefully convince your enemy, that another landing is taking place. And if that causes them or leads them to hold reserves and put defensive forces up there, that makes the actual landing easier.
How many American and Allied troops land on D-Day?
On the first day, 150,000. Within a month, approximately 1 million arrive. We're talking about dozens of divisions. The Germans are simply not able to match the manpower of the Allies. And in particular, the United States, in the second half of 1944 and through May of 1945, when the Germans surrender, they're contributing more and more troops, and they're arriving through Normandy and then fanning out in the territory that is conquered following D-Day.
How do you get that many troops? You said 150,000. How do you get 150,000 across the English Channel in one day?
In specially designed boats, there were two types. One was known as a landing ship tank, but there were only a few hundred of them, and the high command was holding them back for evacuation of casualties. So the brunt of the landing force came in two types of boats. They were known as Higgins boats after the entrepreneur who built them at a shipyard in New Orleans. So most of the Higgins boats were designed to bring personnel in. And so you look at famous photographs of troops arriving in D-Day, whether it's in the early hours or later, they're packed shoulder to shoulder in these high-walled boats with shallow drafts so that they can reach the shore, to get as close as possible to the shore before they drop the gates and the troops rush off.
Mm-hmm. Who are these troops, these 150,000 who are showing that? It's obviously there's Americans, as you said, there's British, there's Canadians, but are they new recruits? Are they battle-seasoned veterans? Do they pull American troops from the Pacific because they know how to fight? Like, who are the young men who are actually in these boats heading to the shore?
Well, they're not pulled from the Pacific. And so a lot of these recruits have not seen much combat. And so for them, this is truly indoctrination under fire, because these are troops that will be touching German territory for the first time if they survive the deadly withering fire that German defenders were able to put down on the morning of June 6th.
And on the German side, who's waiting for them? What kind of troops are there? Who are they commanded by? How significant is the force that the Americans and the German, the British and the Canadians are facing?
Well, the most formidable defenders are the 21st Panzers under the commander of General Rommel. And in a fluke that benefited the Allies, Rommel was on leave in Germany. It was his wife's birthday. And so he was not physically present on D-Day and had to rush back. There had also been a disagreement between Rommel and his commander, General Walter Rundstedt, over how many forces to place close to the expected landing points. For the Germans, the key to blunting the landings is to rush to the point of landing as soon as possible. And here's where Allied air power plays a crucial role. On D-Day, the night before, and then continuing on D-Day, more than 11,000 Allied aircraft were used. 6,000 of them were fighters. The rest were heavy bombers. Compare that to the German air defense, just 800 planes, of which only 300 were fighters, and they only flew 100 sorties, that is, 100 individual missions. Air supremacy meant that the Allies could slow down arriving defending forces, giving the landing forces, the Allied landing forces, adequate time to establish a foothold. That's why the situation at Omaha Beach is so crucial. At one point, the command thinks maybe we have to stop it and bring these troops in at a different beach, which would have really slowed down the landing because they were taking so many casualties. This is because that particular beach, Omaha, just favors the defenders. You have these towering cliffs and the so-called Atlantic Wall, which the Germans constructed starting in 1942, enabled them to put down a nearly inescapable line of heavy fire. And there was no place to take cover on those open beaches in the shallow waters.
So on that day, a lot in a I imagine in a massive operation like this, a lot depends on the weather. We might forget that. And certainly these days where we can just pull up our phone and check what the weather's going to be 2 weeks from now. And it's, you know, amazingly accurate.
Right.
What are the concerns? What's the weather situation facing the Allies?
The weather situation is very precarious. There's a narrow window of opportunity in early June to carry this landing out because of the weather and because of tides. And there's a delay because of weather. But June 6th provides adequate conditions to carry out the landing.
So the other thing that I was thinking of, besides the sort of logistics, you know, the forces arrayed against each other, the logistics, the weather, is also the leadership involved. You have a multinational allied force. I suspect, unlike the Germans, they're not used to fighting with each other. I don't know if they had done joint campaigns before, the British, Americans, and Canadians, but certainly not of this magnitude. And it's an amphibious landing. I think it's the largest amphibious landing in the history of the world, at least up to that point. How in the world do you command such a thing? Who's in charge of it? And how does the command structure and situation work?
Well, the Allies were fortunate to have American General Dwight D. Eisenhower in place as the Supreme Commander. And if General George Marshall, who was Chief of Staff, Army Chief of Staff, had had his way, he would have been present in Europe leading this offensive. But President Franklin Roosevelt told Marshall, "What would I do if you're not here?" Meaning here in Washington, helping me strategize and oversee this. And so the dutiful soldier that he was, Marshall did not push it. And so the command fell to Dwight D. Eisenhower, a career officer, a graduate of West Point, but one who had never seen combat directly himself. Because of his talents, shortly after his graduation from West Point, he was kept stateside to train other officers during World War I. But as a staff officer for General Douglas MacArthur, long service in the Philippines and in the Army during the interwar years, he develops the skills and the leadership to oversee this unprecedented invasion. As you noted, Jeff, this was the largest amphibious invasion in military or world history. And more than that, amphibious landings as a part of military strategy were almost always used as raids or diversions or to probe an enemy's weakness. They were not a full frontal attack as we see here. And Eisenhower understood that overseeing all the attacking forces, the Canadians, the British, the Americans, and being responsible for the success of this mission, it lay on his shoulders. And we think about how in this day and age, we're bombarded with texts and emails and push notifications and whatnot. Of course, that doesn't exist in World War II. But let's imagine Dwight D. Eisenhower with about 10 smartphones going off all the time, because that's what his command center is like, with all the messages coming in. And he's got to assess an incredible amount of information, process it in real time, and make life or death decisions about them. Just to give you one example, what is the role of the French resistance in supporting the D-Day invasion? This falls on his shoulders as well. And as Eisenhower also knew, even if there were circumstances beyond his control and the landings failed, he was the one responsible. And so on June 5th, 1944, he scribbled a brief note, which read as follows. "Our landings in the Cherbourg Havre area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." Now, that note, of course, was never printed and released because the landings succeeded.
So he had this written up in anticipation of taking the blame, the sole responsibility for failure.
Yes. You can easily find the scan of the original. It's in his handwriting on a plain piece of paper. Because he had bad handwriting, you can also find a transcribed version easily.
But that's really remarkable. Can you just say a little bit more about Eisenhower's character and his leadership and how he sort of came to rise to the level of Supreme Allied Commander over this operation?
Sure. Well, I think it's really a slow but steady journey through the ranks. during the tough interwar years, we often forget that the U.S. military services were much neglected during the 1920s and especially during the 1930s, during the Depression years. And I think one thing that made Roosevelt an excellent decision maker, a great delegator, and an insightful strategist was negotiating the bureaucracy and the government during those tough interwar years, defending the Army's interests, understanding how to coax money from Congress, working with a variety of personalities. His patience skills must have been greatly enhanced serving under Douglas MacArthur.
Yeah.
who was not known in history for his
right,
modesty.
To get me with anybody?
Yeah, exactly.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So Eisenhower, was he known to be, I mean, when I think of Eisenhower today, I think a lot of folks think of President Eisenhower, who's sort of a reserved fellow, doesn't say too much, a steady hand, calm. Is that also what General Eisenhower was like?
Yes, yes. Now, General Eisenhower, like President Eisenhower, had a temper, but it was one that he displayed in rare and we might say necessary moments. He did have conflict. One of the most famous examples is with his British counterpart, General Bernard Montgomery. And this brings consequences in the post-D-Day phase, which is another very important part of the story. What comes after D-Day? Because it's not just about establishing that foothold. A few months after D-Day, Montgomery wanted to move his forces in a concentrated push through the northern end of the German defensive line, known as the Siegfried Line or the West Wall. The purpose, to strike deep into Germany and perhaps even force a surrender. Now, the advantages to Montgomery's plan was that even with the Normandy beach held safely, the number of supplies that could flow in, even around the clock, were limited. And so a smaller but better armed force moving quickly could offset that. But as Eisenhower saw it, what we need here is a broad front. We can't just have one push. And so he made the decision that Montgomery should take German-held ports in Belgium especially, and that American troops under the command of General Omar Bradley and George Patton could take the Czar River area. This would put the Allies into a position to enter Germany from both sides of the Ruhr, which is its industrial area. So there's this conflict that develops, and Eisenhower ultimately prevails.
Mm. And obviously he has the backing of President Roosevelt. Does Eisenhower also have the backing of probably the other most important Western leader, Winston Churchill?
You know, that's a rather interesting subject, because I think Churchill was holding back on what he thought Eisenhower should do and was trying to work on the Roosevelt end, since he had a closer relationship with Roosevelt. To give you one example of this, at the Tehran conference in November and December of 1943, this is the first meeting between Roosevelt and Stalin, and Churchill is present too. Here, Roosevelt and Stalin push for what becomes known as a Southern D-Day or Operation Anvil. This is a landing from the Mediterranean onto French soil to take the port of Marseille. Churchill was opposed to this, but you know, rather than working on this at the military command level, he's hoping to change minds at the civilian leadership level. But Stalin and Roosevelt outvoted, you know, it's their decision.
Right. Well, all right. So if we're on June 6, 1944, and thinking about that day and then forward, think about the consequences and the effects also, as you say, of D-Day. Let me ask you this. Based on the Allied air supremacy, based on the number of troops that are successfully able to get over, based on the good weather, the outstanding command leadership, and obviously just supplies and personnel, is there a moment when D-Day, when Eisenhower's note might have had to have been released? Was D-Day ever actually in doubt?
Well, I think had the Germans made better defensive decisions and had the defenders at Omaha Beach been able to slow down the landings a little bit more, and let's say the command decision is made, let's call it off and try and bring these forces in at Juneau or Sword or Utah. These are some of the other five beaches. Then we might be talking about a repulsed or slowed down landing. But I do think the circumstances and the planning and preparation that went into Normandy really push us towards saying it was going to happen one way or another and succeed.
Mm. What's the effect of the successful landing? By the time you get to day one, two, and three, and it's clear a beachhead has been established, the Germans have been pushed back, the Allies are here to stay in northwestern France. What's the effect? What's the effect in France? What's the effect back in Germany? What's the effect in Russia? What's the effect in America, Britain? What's the kind of, not just military, but sort of political, geostrategic effect of this successful operation?
So in the days and weeks following June 6th, there is intense and heavy fighting to take the territory of Normandy. This is known as Battlefield Bocage. The Bocage, B-O-C-A-G-E, is a particular type of hedge that has been grown for centuries in Normandy and historically used by the farmers of the area to mark lots. And they provided a very dense, effective shield for the defenders, who might think, well, you know, how could shrubs stand up to modern weapons? But they were so dense and heavy that they provided this sort of cover that could allow defenders to inflict heavy casualties, and they did. So for the next several days, for a few weeks, securing that area of Normandy is necessary. From there, more territory taken. And in mid-July 1944, Rommel informed Hitler that the situation was hopeless. Now, just 5 days later, there's an assassination attempt against Hitler that almost succeeds. So we can see there's some turmoil within the German military command. But Hitler's able to survive and establish control and deal with the plotters and turn to generals who were not part of it. Then there needs to be a breakout. So from this point, Operation D-Day becomes Operation Cobra. This is supported by heavy bombing, and then troops commanded by General Omar Bradley take a key city of France, of northern France, Avranches. This is the last German counteroffensive. So this is why it's important. Three panzer divisions, which had been stationed at Pas-de-Calais for the invasion there that never happened, were rushed back to try and stop Operation Cobra. But they did not, and heavy losses were inflicted upon the Germans. So within a month and a half, within 6 weeks of D-Day, we have that crucial victory.
So what happens then, what's the effect politically then in places like Russia, England, America?
Well, in the United States, obviously this is a much watched and followed event and cheered by the public. Politically, it's a major accomplishment for Roosevelt because now he can begin to speak of the Allies closing in on Germany.
It is, and it happens to also be his, he's in a presidential election year, right?
Yes,
running for his term.
Fourth term. And it, amazingly, Roosevelt did not announce he was going to seek a fourth term until the summer, the late summer of 1944, almost before the convention. He was keeping everyone up in the air, though, you know, for close and astute observers, the signs were there that Roosevelt was going to run again. But certainly these Allied gains help him politically. By August of 1944, Paris is liberated. And the de facto leader of France in exile, General Charles de Gaulle, arrives triumphantly in Paris. At this point, the French also begin contributing troops, several divisions, to the Allied offensives. So in those landings in southern France, although U.S. divisions are the first to land, they're followed by French troops raised in North Africa. So France begins to make a meaningful contribution to Allied gains against Germany at this point. So this is a great moment for France. You know, some of the sting of the defeat in 1940 is lessened by France being a contributing partner to this. For the Soviets, for Stalin, this is a welcome development, but it is a bittersweet one. If we go back to May of 1942, Stalin dispatched his foreign minister, Molotov, to meet personally with Franklin Roosevelt and General Marshall. And at this meeting, which we have a good record of, notes were taken by a man named Charles Bolin, who often worked closely with Roosevelt and was fluent in Russian. And these notes from Charles Bolin indicate that Molotov directly asked Roosevelt and Marshall for the Allies to open a second front in Europe as soon as possible. And this meant northern France. Marshall himself pushed for this, saying that if we let the Red Army go down, this would be the greatest defeat in world history, and we may not be able to beat the Germans without the Soviets. But Roosevelt decided to go with Churchill's preferred entry into the European theater, Operation Torch in North Africa. That did not alleviate the pounding the Soviets were taking. When we look at the global casualties of World War II, they're mind-boggling. 50 million. And of that 50 million, the majority were Soviet. The costs, the damage inflicted by the German invasion that started in June of 1941, the relentless annihilationist fighting taking place from the summer of 1941, really through the end of the war, this inflicts terrible, terrible casualties on the Soviets. When you look at a graphic of the military casualties of the belligerents in World War II, Axis and Ally, you can't even chart the Soviets. They stack up, up, and up.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So if it has that relief effect in Russia, does it have the effect, as you mentioned already, there was a plot against Hitler. Does the successful invasion on D-Day accelerate the plot? The German generals start saying, hey, we got to get rid of this guy. We could lose here, and we need to get rid of him.
Yeah, there's this intensifying momentum to get rid of Hitler. And it's not just D-Day. Hitler's just making one bad decision after another. And for the German military professionals, for his generals, there's a growing recognition that these blunders are going to be overwhelming, and they need to be stopped if there's going to be any salvaging of the Germany they want. I mean, they're also acutely aware that the Allies have declared a policy of unconditional surrender. And in a way, they're hoping that if they can dispatch Hitler, the Allies might make a concession and not take total control of defeated Germany and reconstitute its government according to their wishes, which is, of course, what does happen.
I know sometimes historians are reluctant to sort of tell us about lessons learned. But, you know, we always like to, in these podcasts, think about what, if we study this historical, important historical moment, are there insights that we can glean from it that either for that time or even for our own thinking today that are helpful?
Do you mean in terms of what we learned from D-Day?
What we learned from D-Day, yeah. Lessons learned about the war, about leadership, about important elements that we just see in vivid relief there on D-Day.
You know, I think what D-Day vividly highlights for us is what war is like for those who are in the thick of it and who die or are horribly wounded, or if they live, they see death all around them. We're reminded that this is what war looks like. And even for the survivors, it is going to have a lifetime traumatic effect upon them. Then let's trace that back to how those brave troops arrived in the first place. American industrial might. The ability of the Allies to overwhelm their enemies with planes, bullets, boots, sewing machines even. Lend-Lease, the program through which the United States supplied its allies, sent sewing machines to India, then still a colony of Great Britain, where Indian laborers produced parachutes. The Axis are just not able to do this, even though the Germans carry out forced labor based upon intentional starvation in order to save food for their populations. They cannot match it even with that level of brutality and the treatment of enslaved labor forces. We have the ingenuity of American engineers and inventors to bring the Norden bomb sight, which is crucial to the success of Allied air power, which again makes D-Day possible. At the height of B-17 production at Henry Ford's great plant at Willow Run in Michigan, the laborers there, so many of them women, were turning out a B-17 every hour. I mean, imagine that, a heavy bomber every hour. And this is round-the-clock production. What pays for that? So you have to have that financial base. And so the American people are out of the Depression. They're making good wages, but there's rationing in place. And, you know, this is something else I think we can look at on D-Day and then sort of take back to the home front. People sacrificing luxuries and also recognizing that they have to share the necessities of life, sugar, gasoline, and so much more in order to feed those troops and make sure they can carry this out. So I think, you know, looking at D-Day, but the other offensives of World War II, we can start with those who are at the spearhead, so to speak, and then go back to the people who put the rivets in the planes, or the farmers, you know, producing the food that is not just feeding American troops, the American population, but other allied troops and populations as well.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, including the ingenious Higgins boat, which I think Dwight Eisenhower said, Higgins is the man who won the war for us.
Well, you know, I've been trying to track that quote down, Jeff, and I've not been able to pin it down.
Well, I'm not a historian, so allow me to spell things that are apocryphal as truth.
Yes. Yeah. We'll create a new category, like history that should be true.
That's right.
So, you know, let's say that Dwight D. Eisenhower didn't actually say that. It does speak to a larger historical reality that those boats were crucial to victory, not just on D-Day, but they were also essential in the Pacific, where you have, you know, many D-Days taking place constantly throughout 1944 and into 1945.
If our listeners want to read things about D-Day and the American and Canadian and British invasion, if they want to watch things, what are you recommending as some of the best history and best, most compelling storytelling about D-Day?
Well, I think we should always start with the voices of those who were there. So there are many memoirs of American troops, as well as other troops who were there at D-Day. So I encourage people to look for these memoirs. It's also helpful to place D-Day into the larger context. And I do think that, especially on the American side, we tend to emphasize D-Day as the most crucial battle and the turning point. And it was crucial. It was a turning point. But without those Soviet victories, D-Day and the defeat of the Axis powers, particularly Germany, is not possible. So there are a couple of good books that for a reader interested in a global view of the war, and one that looks at all of the contributing parts, for example, the British and Canadian part. My go-to books are Thomas Zeiler, Annihilation, A Global History of World War II, and then a book by the British historian Evan Maudsley, Maudsley, World War II, A New History. So these are both highly readable, comprehensive studies by historians who have spent decades of their lives reading all these other books and distilling them down to the most essential information in an engaging narrative.
Please. Yeah, what else?
You know, my viewing habits on World War II, I have to admit, have not included D-Day lately. So I still think that the opening scene of Saving Private Ryan, just that scene, I don't think it's a good movie about D-Day, but I think the opening scenes really depict to the best of cinema's abilities what it was like to be there. But my most recent World War II viewing is Masters of the Air, which is about the 8th U.S. Air Force stationed in southern England and many of their veterans.
Okay, Masters of the Air, very good. You know, and when I think of course, some of the memorable commentary or speech making about D-Day, my mind goes back, maybe because I'm an American, but my mind goes back to Ronald Reagan's speech on the 40th anniversary, The Boys of Pontiac. Is that worthy reading for our listeners?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It is. It's useful to look at the speeches of later American leaders who were touched by the war in one way or another. That includes Ronald Reagan, although he did not see combat and was not deployed overseas. He did make propaganda films in Hollywood, so he was in the war in that sense, and of course living through it and seeing its effects. And his successor as president, George H.W. Bush, was a decorated combat veteran of World War II. So I think when we see leaders like Reagan and Bush, or Jimmy Carter too, who saw service briefly at the end of the war. He was graduated hurriedly from the U.S. Naval Academy. When they make reference to the war, I think it has an outsized importance because they lived it.
Fascinating. Well, it's an opportunity for us on this 80th anniversary to relive it ourselves a little bit, rethink it, and reappreciate the courage, the heroism, and the sacrifice of those who are involved. David, thanks for taking us back in time to that really important moment in world history. David Krueger, again, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. It's been a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.